Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On part one of this two-part conversation, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to Dr. Kevin Curry Knight, associate professor at East Carolina University's College of Education. The two discuss self-directed learning, or unschooling. COVID-19 is scrambling the deck on the options parents have for their children. Dr. Curry Knight believes creating organic and authentic environments where children self-direct their learning is increasingly relevant to how our modern world and economy work. The two discuss what the day-to-day of self-directed learning looks like, intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, and more. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode. So we're excited today to have Kevin Curry Knight, who is an associate professor at East Carolina University. Kevin's part of the College of Education in the Department of Special Education, Foundations, and Research. So Kevin, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you're a fascinating thinker, and I'm looking forward to this. You and I have a similar background. I also went through a Foundations of Education department, so this will be a lot of fun for me. You've done a lot of very interesting things, and what I'm really fascinated with initially is the work that you've done with a school called Pathfinder Community School. You're very interested in learning environments that are much more organic and authentic than oftentimes what we see in schooling. So why don't we start there? Talk a little bit about, you know, your views on unschooling, on what the Pathfinder Community School is trying to accomplish. Let's start with your understanding of what you mean by self-directed instruction, self-directed in learning, why that's important.
I guess the way to do it is just to tell the brief story of how I got into it. So I'm a former public school high school teacher. I got my PhD, became a professor at ECU, and all throughout that time, I was really conventional in terms of education. You know, not like just lecture and drill, but I would always try to make it fun and engaging. But I was always of the mindset that there's just things that kids need to know. It's my job as a teacher to give that to them. I'm the one they listen to. I give them the assignments. I craft everything. And whether they want to do it or not, you know, it's kind of tough. It's for their own good. Right. And ironically, I was preparing for a course that I teach at ECU about kind of the best theory and research on learning and motivation and how it occurs. And I'm doing this research, and bit by bit, I'm finding things in the research that just kind of contradict or at least question the way we do things, including the way I was doing them in all of my classrooms. So you find things like the idea that interest, student interest, positively correlates with every single educational outcome you can think of. The idea that intrinsic motivation is way more powerful than extrinsic motivators. So we motivate kids by grades and tokens and punishments and things. And all the while, it seems like intrinsic motivation, it's just widely agreed, is way more powerful.
Right.
And then you would come across, research on video games. So there's been a lot of educators who've researched video games and how they work, because if you think about it, video games are this learning tool. Right. Like you have to keep learning and learning and learning to beat a game. And like, why are video games so powerful at getting kids like absorbed in them, but schools aren't? And there's a whole lot of reasons for that, including intrinsic motivation and stuff. Anyway, I start looking at this research, and I'm just bit by bit realizing that the way school is constructed is looking like it's often getting in the way of learning. And if this research is true, and it seemed to be everywhere I looked, it was validated, then the way we're doing things in school can't be right. Like the idea that we're going to force kids to learn things that they have no interest in, and we're going to do it by giving them grades and rewards and punishments and things like that, it just seems so off kilter. And the more I questioned, the more I started seeing these alternative models of school that give kids more freedom. And I kept going down that rabbit hole until I saw things like Sudbury schools or Agile Learning Centers, which are essentially places kids go where there's no requirements on what you learn or what you do with your time. You just do whatever you want. There's like different rooms with a whole bunch of stuff, and they don't even have people called teachers. They call them staff. And the idea is that they're not teachers because they're not presenting kids with stuff unless the kids ask for it. And what I noticed about those schools is that even though it's a small sample size, so some people like to argue that it's not representative of kids at large, these schools, the kids turn out fine. the kids who want to go to college go to college, despite often have had any formal education in classes. They don't come out with grades, they don't come out with transcripts, but somehow they get into college and they do fine. So that just got me thinking. It's really interesting that this 13-year period of school that we say is so crucial to development, you have these schools where they don't get any of it, and yet the kids turn out fine. The outcomes say that these kids are not harmed in any way by not having those 13 years. So that's what Pathfinder Community School is, right? I should say in some sense was, because of the COVID events and the shutdowns, we've had to subsequently close our doors. But it's this idea that what learning should be is kids living their lives, figuring out what they need to know in the course of living your life. And then when you find something you feel like you need to know or want to know, having the resources available to you, including staff members who can support you, and doing it then. And not doing it for grades and not doing it for points and not doing it for tests, but doing it for the reasons most of us learn things when we need to know them. Because I really want to do this thing and I have to learn it in order to do this other thing, so I'm going to do it.
Well, you know, for 200,000 years, our species has been learning outside of a formal sort of structure that we call schooling today. And of course, this is a fairly recent phenomenon, I mean, 150 years, maybe 170 years, in which we've sort of decided to mass produce educated people in sort of a structured, standardized way. But isn't it so deeply ingrained now that it'd be hard to change, right? People are so indoctrinated into thinking this is the only way to educate people. I mean, do you see any way to move forward?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely agree with what you say. And when I really realized how strong the effect of school is on how we think about kids and learning, I was reading a book of history by Howard Chudikoff called How Old Are You? And it's a book about age consciousness in America and how age consciousness came about. And he has a chapter in there about education. And he says some really powerful stuff, including, you know, it's in the late 1700s, no one would have thought it was unusual for kids of different ages to be learning the same stuff. It just didn't occur to anyone that this was an unusual thing. It was only really with the 1800s and especially the mid-1800s, the rise of like age-graded schooling, that we really started to think about it. But if you think about it today, when a kid tells you they're in fifth grade, that's like the most natural thing in the world. It's like, there's nothing odd about that. We were talking before we came on air that, you know, my child right now, who's 4.5, is called a preschooler. And just everyone, naturally, he's a preschooler. It's so weird that the first word we can think of to describe someone who's 4.5 is about their proximity to school. So it really is such a powerfully ingrained thing. In terms of getting beyond that, I really don't know. It's because school has such a almost monopoly position on the way we think of childhood. I'm really not sure exactly what, if anything, will bypass that. I think what's going to happen, honestly, is that history will take care of it in the sense that school will become so, at least school as it's done now, will become so increasingly irrelevant to the way the world actually works as we go forward, that more and more people are just going to say, you know, why, what's the point of this? Why do it this way when I could do it another way?
Do you think that all the changes with the pandemic, I mean, there's this whole movement towards learning pods, micro schools, homeschooling, virtual education, hybrid programs where kids are on campus a couple days a week and they're in the community or at home a couple days a week. I mean, is this the beginning of parents sort of reasserting control over their kids' education, starting to deindustrialize and destandardize and move towards more customization? I mean, could something like this come out of the pandemic?
It could. I'm optimistic in some ways and I'm pessimistic in other ways. The ways that I'm optimistic is I'm seeing a lot of stories in the news and from people who are saying, you know, wow, I thought, first of all, this was going to be really hard. It's actually not all that hard. I mean, different people's situations differ. But also things like, I'm seeing a lot of news stories about, you know, kids are reporting a decrease in anxiety and stress. And I know a lot of parents and kids get used to thinking that the anxiety and stress was just something about them. But then when their kids are out of school, all of a sudden they realize that the anxiety and stress kind of goes away. I'm seeing other stories, and again, these are news stories, so they're kind of selective. They're probably, they have some bias in them. Stories about how a lot of some kid parents are finding that kids are more self-directed and self-sufficient now that the pandemic is kind of on us, and after the first few weeks of kind of getting used to having to design your own schedule, that a lot of kids are doing pretty well with that. But then I'm also pessimistic because I think the culture at large is treating this as we're in this holding pattern and we're going to stay here until we go back to school. But the goal is, I want, this is like a stopgap to get our kids back to school. So ideally it would be that, wow, you know, my kid, it seems to be learning fine. I'm not really going to stress too much about keeping them on grade level in math. But if your goal is to send them back to school when they go into third grade and they have to be on grade level, you don't really have that luxury. There's always going to be that voice in your head that says, no, I really should keep them on grade level in math.
Yeah, you keep hearing people say how horrendous it is that kids go through a whole year without learning. I'm thinking to myself, no, right. Of course they're learning. I mean, they may not be learning necessarily what's in the state-approved curriculum scope and sequence, but they're certainly learning. It's just a different kind of thing. So, but it's like, no, they can't be learning if they're not in school.
Yeah, I think when we talk about learning, and even in teacher ed programs like the one I'm in, we often do this not deliberately. We talk about learning as this general thing where either you're learning or you're not. And if you are excited about learning, I could put anything in front of you and you just want to learn it. And if you're not excited about learning math, therefore you're not excited about learning. And it's not a general thing. I think all of us, if we think about our experience and we look at the people around us, everyone's excited about learning certain things and not excited about learning other things.
Right.
So what I like to tell parents is if your child's home and, you know, they don't really want to read poetry or learn anything about science, it's not that they don't want to learn. It's that maybe they don't want to learn that particular thing, at least at this time. It might be that they are fine learning other things. We talk about learning as this general thing where either you want to learn or you don't. And it seems to be more domain specific.
I'd like to give our listeners a more specific picture in their mind about what it looks like when kids have way more control over their learning and they're in much more authentic environments as opposed to a structured school. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? What would it look like if my 9-year-old, you know, spends the next 2 months having control over her learning? You know, what's that look like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. Well, I guess I should probably plug a podcast that I work on with Gina Riley, who's another researcher in self-directed education. It's called Learning by Living podcast. And we talk to people who either have learned in those environments or staff members at those environments. So I'm kind of going to relate to you some of what they usually say, because we often ask them a similar question. What does that look like? And they usually say something like, it looks like a whole bunch of kids just doing stuff that they want to do, and not every kid is doing the same thing. And some of them, to be quite honest, are just hanging out and talking all day. And some of them are, to be honest, playing video games all day. And some of them are out playing sports. One of the things I've learned from talking to unschoolers and people who work at Sudbury Schools and, of course, Pathfinder, is that I think one of the scary things about watching kids control their time is that if you expect that what they're going to do is learn all the time, that's not what you're going to see. You're going to see them doing stuff all the time. And then at some point, they're going to find something that they need to learn in order to do the stuff that they're doing. So in some schools, that is often like a lot of kids spend time in the cooking room, you know, the kitchen and the cooking room. And they realize at some point, like, I have to learn some level of math to do this. Otherwise, I can't do it well. And what these schools often report, and I've seen it happen, is that when kids are interested and they stumble across something they want to learn, it doesn't take them long. It takes them usually a very short amount of time because they're doing it obsessively. They're doing it because they have a reason to do it. And they could spend hours on it if they really want to spend hours on it. So I'll usually say this. Yeah, it's if you give kids freedom over their learning, don't expect them to simply be learning all the time. Expect them to be doing things all the time. But at some point, you know, they're going to learn stuff. It's kind of like if you have a few weeks of time completely to yourself, I wouldn't expect you to learn all the time, right? I would expect you to do things you want to do. And of course, you would learn in the course of doing those things, what you want to learn when you want to learn it. But learning wouldn't be your chief objective. Doing would be your chief objective. Yeah, I think, but also I think a lot of people would be surprised at how tenaciously people will learn once they have a reason to learn something. So one of the things that always amazes people about schools like this and unschooling research is that kids who are unschooled or kids who go to Sudbury schools or ALC schools, they're not taught to read. There's no reading class there unless kids want one, but they all learn to read. And everyone's like, well, how does that happen? Why would they learn to read? And the answer is, think about it. Look around you. Look at how much text there is around you. Imagine you're a kid who can't decipher that text and how frustrating that would be. At some point, every kid gets to a point where they realize that if I want to do certain things, I have to learn to read. And then for some kids, they learn to read on their own. And when you ask them, how did you do it? They literally can't tell you because they don't. It wasn't a really conscious process. Other kids ask for help and like, I need someone to help me read this. Some kids, it takes them a year to learn to read. Some kids, it takes them a few months to learn to read. It almost never takes them the amount of time that we take in school, which is probably way longer than I think I've ever heard a story of in a self-directed learning environment. So yeah, I mean, what it looks like is just kids doing stuff they want to do. And at some point, you need to learn stuff to do what you want to do. And just like all of us, we find out how to do it.
You reminded me that when I was a very young kid, I loved sports. And I'm pretty sure I learned how to read on the sports page of my local newspaper, because I would get up every morning and run out to get the newspaper. And I would go right to the sports section. I mean, you know, 4 or 5 years old, and just consume the sports section of the newspaper. And I think that's, I was just, that's how I learned how to read.
Yeah, our son is 4 and a half, and we're kind of reading to him every night before bed, just like two stories is kind of a ritual. And he's getting to the point where he's starting to kind of express interest in, like a week ago, he asked me, Daddy, what's that? And it was a quotation mark. So I explained to him what a quotation mark is, because he knows all of his letters and stuff. Yeah. And so now he's trying to figure out, like, okay, that's a quotation mark. And I'm sure he's trying to put together what I'm reading and what he's seeing and seeing if he can line it up. It's just an organic process. And I guess the lesson from unschoolers is that for every kid, it's really different. There's a different entry point into reading or math or whatever it is, and there's a different process. Some kids really want help, and our job as, let's say, staff at a learning center or parents of an unschooled kid is to help them, not to force it on them, but to help them when they ask. And then other kids, they just want to do it on their own, and they'll find a way to do it on their own.
So you've already addressed some of the criticisms, but I wanted to, you know, be a little more direct on some of that, which is, you know, how will a child know what the right things that they should be learning? Shouldn't adults be guiding them in cases forcing them, because they don't know what it takes to be prepared to be a successful adult in a modern economy? The adults do. So our responsibility as teachers and parents is to make sure that they have all the knowledge and skills they need to be successful. And if you leave it to them to make those decisions, they're going to end up with major holes in their preparation to be successful adults. So how would unschoolers respond to that criticism?
There's actually several responses. The first one is that I think in some ways there's some truth to that, but unschooling or self-directed learning doesn't rule out the possibility that you can do things in front of your kids or try to like, hey, you said you want to do this. In my experience, you need math to do that. You would stop short of forcing those things on them, but you would kind of guide them through it. In fact, one of the interviews we did on Learning by Living was with a staff member at the Hudson Valley Sudbury School, and he tells a story that a lot of other people have told, which is that, you know, at some point kids get to an age where they're like, well, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Like, what do I want to do with my career? And a lot of them decide they want to go to college, and then they'll say to a staff member, hey, I'm thinking about maybe going to college. And then the staff member's like, oh, well, have you figured out what you need to do that? And then the kid will be like, well, I think I had some ideas, and the staff member might volunteer some information. But once the child knows what they need to do, they'll often seek out advice. Like, what do I need to do to make this happen, to go to college, to become a veterinarian, or whatever it is? So that's one. There's nothing that says that you can't or shouldn't be kind of exposing your kids to things. But by expose, we don't mean force. We mean just kind of, hey, this seems kind of cool, don't you think? So there's that. Another thing I'd say is that I'm not sure. I think we may overemphasize how obvious the point is that adults know best what kids need to know. Because first of all, kids, especially as they grow up, I mean, you know, they're smart enough to figure out things as they go along. They're smart enough to kind of look around them and say, oh, I want to be a business person, and I'm looking at all these business people and they seem to know this. Maybe I should learn that too. But also, I use myself as an example of, you know, the world changes, and adults, especially curriculum designers, aren't necessarily in the best place to know what I'm going to need 12 years from when I'm a kindergartner. So when I was a kid, I guess this dates me a little bit, but I was born, you know, when I was in high school, the internet was kind of a thing that was kind of in the air, but no one really thought that people would have home computers and be wedded to the internet the way they are. So one thing we learned in elementary school a lot was cursive. I remember spending a lot of time learning cursive in my like first, second, third grade, because, you know, handwriting was still a really important skill, and no one had any reason to think it wasn't going to be. And what I didn't learn, even in high school, was how to navigate the web. I didn't learn anything about email etiquette. No one used email at that point, or probably few people did. I didn't learn how to navigate hyperlinks. I didn't learn any of that. I had to learn that on my own. I learned typing because people had a vague sense that people would have PCs. But anyway, that's just a way to say that I don't know if it's so obvious that adults are the best people to know what kids need to know. I mean, the other example I guess I'll use is that I hear a lot of my colleagues talking about how kids need to learn how to the etiquette of writing business letters and things like that. From what I've heard from millennials, it's much more common to communicate with people in your office through instant message nowadays. And there's a whole different etiquette for IM than there is for business letters. No one would IM the way you write a business letter. Right. So again, it's just a way to say that adults are often so wedded to the way they're used to it that they assume that that's what other kids, that kids are going to need to know. And sometimes that's true, and sometimes that's false. And I guess the last thing I would say is that in this day and age, it's easier than ever to learn things when you decide you need them. I think in the 1950s and 60s, it would have been way easier to think, well, you either learn it now in school or you just don't learn it unless you like can go to the library and find a book on it. In this day and age, that doesn't really obtain much anymore. It's a lot easier to find things you need when you need them. I guess actually there is one more thing that I would say, which is an answer that's given to Gina and I whenever we do the Learning by Living podcast. We often ask about gaps in your knowledge. When you were an adult, after being unschooled, did you find that there were gaps in your knowledge that other kids didn't have? And they always say almost the same thing. They say, well, yeah, but they also had gaps that I didn't have. So like I needed to learn how to like properly use a comma, but they didn't know how to manage their finances because they never had to. So their point is that, yeah, I had gaps in my knowledge, but so did they. Everyone has gaps in their knowledge. It's not whether you'll have them, it's what gaps you have.
You know, I just asked our HR department to eliminate all the college degree requirements from our job descriptions, mm-hmm. unless it was something they had to make the case to me that you had to have a college degree. Because what I noticed is that some of my best IT folks, for example, some didn't go to college or had very little college, because fields are changing so rapidly that, you know, I want to know, do you have the competencies today to do what I need you to do today? Mm-hmm. The fact that you had a college degree, you know, 20 years ago doesn't necessarily mean you have the skill. Yeah. In IT, it's very obvious, but there's lots of other fields too that are changing so rapidly. I want to know that the employee is a robust learner, is excited about continuous learning, as opposed to had a college degree 15 years ago, because I don't know whether that's relevant for today.
Yeah, I've actually had some folks who hire for IT companies, who I'll keep nameless, say something like that to me. They actually say, when I look at job applications, I'm probably biased against people with a college degree, because in my experience, they need things to be taught to them because that's the way it was expected that they learned. Whereas the folks who don't have a college degree were usually self-taught,
right,
and they're usually used to that environment of, right, of, you know, you, every few years, if you're not self-teaching the changes in the field,
right,
that's probably true of most any field. I think it's almost an illusion to think, like, you know, I teach teachers, and when you go into teaching every 5 years, the expectations are going to be different. There's a new idea for curriculum, there's a new way to write lesson plans, there's new assessment methods, there's new technologies that come in. So the idea that you learn it in college and then you go and teach and you're never going to have to relearn stuff, or that college is like, that's going to equip you for the knowledge that you need for the rest of your career, it's just untenable.
Well, the pandemic is really, I think, exposing that in education. So many teachers are just pulling their hair out because who prepared them for hybrid learning environments, for virtual learning environments? I mean, you know, I feel bad for them. They're being thrown in the deep end of the pool without any kind of preparation. And that's just a good example of almost all their preparation at this point is barely relevant. So they're having to reinvent the whole nature of instruction. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And the thing that I notice with self-directed learners, and there's research that also kind of bears this out, is that they're amazing at kind of self-starting. When you ask them, I actually did ask once a group of unschoolers, because one of my colleagues had asked, well, what do they do when they have gaps in their knowledge? So I went to them and I said, what do y'all do when you have gaps in your knowledge? What should I bring back to my colleague? And they just kind of looked at me like I'm crazy. And they're like, do you mean, what do I do when I don't know stuff? I'm like, well, that's kind of the question. Yeah. And they're like, I find out where I can get the knowledge and I learn it. Yeah. And they just looked at me like, why would you even ask that question? Of course, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's not atypical among self-directed learners, because in Sudbury schools or in a school like Pathfinder or an unschooling environment, that's essentially what you prepare to do for 13 years of your life. You prepare to figure out what you need to know, to diagnose your learning gaps, to figure out where to get that information, and to kind of monitor your progress. You become really good at, I guess, what we call executive functioning.
Right. The other major criticism I think I hear a lot is an equity issue, which is unschooling is sort of a, you know, white bourgeois activity. You know, families are college educated and, you know, and kids who come from environments that don't have a lot of social capital, that are, you know, people are struggling just to survive. You know, it's not an environment that kids need unstructured. They need a lot more structure, which is why they need to be in schools where there's a lot of structure, where they can be exposed to things that they couldn't get exposed to at home. How would you respond to that equity criticism?
I think the equity criticism is justified. I don't think it's as justified as most people think. I think when you look at the data, it's actually surprising. I'm going completely off of memory here, so I may get this wrong, but Gina Riley, my colleague for the podcast, just wrote a book called, I think it's called Unschooling. And in there, she goes into the most recent stats we have, demographic stats of unschoolers. And if I remember right, about 20% only had high school diplomas. It certainly is, and there's way more kind of poverty within that group than one would think, although it's an unusual set of folks with poverty. These are usually college-educated folks who, for ideological reasons, haven't chosen to climb the corporate ladder.
Right.
So there is a lot of, like, college education involved in that, but not as much, I think, as most people would think, just kind of looking in from the outside. The other thing I would say about the equity issue is that I feel the criticism is certainly justified, and it's a big concern within self-directed learning and education spaces, the kind of social justice element of making sure everyone could potentially access this. But I also feel like it's, in some ways, we're getting it from both sides, because people are against school choice for certain reasons, and kind of especially giving funds to people who don't send their kids to any school, which means that the only people who can afford to unschool are people who can pay entirely out of pocket to do it and potentially have a parent at home, which is itself costly. So I feel like the best way to remedy that would be to create a school choice scenario, like an education savings account, something like that, where people could fund their unschooling experience to some degree through the same sort of state subsidy dollars that kids who go to schools of choice would get, or especially kids who go to public schools get. So the problem is often the same people who criticize unschooling as a bourgeois, you have to be financially stable to support it, are the same people who are actively opposed to school choice, which is part of what leads to the problem in the first place.